You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CyberWire's Research Saturday. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is our weekly conversation with researchers and analysts tracking down threats and vulnerabilities and solving some of the hard problems of protecting ourselves in a rapidly evolving cyberspace. Thanks for joining us. And now, a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose Sixth Sense, visit sixthsense.com.
Cyberbunker is one of these real interesting things in security that's sort of a real event made for a movie.
My guests today are Karim Lalji and Johannes Ulrich. Karim Lalji is a security consultant and master's candidate at the SANS Technology Institute. Johannes Ulrich is the Dean of Research at the SANS Technology Institute and a regular contributor to the CyberWire. The research we're discussing today is titled Cyberbunker 2.0, Analysis of the Remnants of a Bulletproof Hosting Provider.
People set up bulletproof hosting facility that, well, usually when you talk bulletproof hosting, you talk about hosting that's hard to take down with abuse complaints. They actually were bulletproof in a Cold War bunker that was actually originally designed to house the German government in case of a nuclear attack. Now, with the end of the Cold War, that bunker became redundant and this group purchased it. And they had about 1 million square feet of space in this bunker until it got raided last year.
Wow. I mean, 1 million square feet is nothing to sniff about. And I suppose we have to give them something for style points.
Yeah, and they had it fully equipped, including a lounge area and everything, if you look at the pictures. So it was a real fancy operation. Now, this is known as Cyberbunker 2.0 because the same group actually did the same thing with a bunker in the Netherlands that just happened to burn out when one of their truck cooking operations kind of went bad.
Now, in terms of bulletproof hosting, I suppose I would have expected those sorts of operations to run in places like Russia, you know, those sort of Eastern Bloc countries. How unusual is it for something like this to run in Germany, for example?
It's very unusual, and that sort of was their downfall in part because, of course, eventually law enforcement became aware of what they were doing, and that's why they got raided.
Well, Karim, why don't you jump in here and explain to us where did your part in all this start when you all took notice of what was going on here?
Yeah, great. It was a really interesting project to work on, actually very enlightening. So as Johannes mentioned, there was this cyber bunker group that was offering bulletproof hosting. And they were hosting, you know, darknet sites, you know, illegal pornography, drug markets, all sorts of things. And in the fall of 2019, the police raided that facility and arrested the individuals that were involved. And they're still actively undergoing trials in Germany. And one of the methods they used to liquidate some assets to help pay for their defense was to sell the IP address space that belonged to this hosting facility. Now, we're talking about a fairly large IPv4 address space, right? So it's 2/22 networks and 1/24 network, which is about 2,300 IPs. Hmm. So when they sold this, they sold it to a company that had a relationship with Johannes and were able to redirect some of that traffic to the SANS Internet Storm Center honeypot so that we could take a peek behind the lid and see what was going on.
Hmm. Well, I mean, let's dig into some of the details here. For folks who might not be deeply familiar with what exactly goes into setting up a honeypot, can you give us a little bit of the background there and then tell us how you applied it to this particular situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So the honeypot was just a host that was set up, internet bound. It had a lot of the common services that you would expect. So things like a web server listening on port 80 and 443, an FTP server as well. So when the traffic got redirected, for example, if it made a request for a website, that would then get trapped by our honeypot and logged by whatever application layer protocol was waiting at that end, for example, an Apache web server. So we had permission to look at any of the traffic aside from email. So we didn't have anything listening on port 25 because we weren't able to inspect email. I presume, and Johannes can correct me if I'm wrong, that had something to do with some of the investigations by law enforcement.
Hmm. Yeah, and part it didn't really want us to look at email because that may have been useful later for law enforcement, and they didn't want us to tamper with any of that evidence, essentially.
I see. Well, so take me through what sort of traffic were you seeing here? I mean, what were folks who were the type of folks who'd be purchasing this sort of bulletproof hosting? What were some of the use cases that you all detected with the honeypot?
Yeah, so we looked specifically for the things that were contained inside of the press release by the Attorney General in Germany, and that was things like botnet traffic and illegal pornography and malicious ads. And we did find evidence of some of that. So we definitely found a fair amount of residual botnet communication. And one thing that's important to note is that the analysis that was undertaken here was about 9 months after the police raid. So these servers have been taken apart. They've been removed from the facility, and then they're being resold to another company. So we're seeing this backscatter traffic 9 months after, and there's still so much of it. So there was a lot of C2 communication using techniques like IRC, as well as encrypted botnet communication, which was tied to specific and known malware families.
What other types of things were coming in?
We saw a lot of residual traffic from malicious ad networks. So just like regular organizations, criminal organizations also leverage ads. And what was interesting about this ad network is the volume. I mean, every few minutes you see a host resolving this ad network with URLs and query strings inside of those URLs that were definitely on the questionable side. I mean, these were adult content. Some of them looked like they might have been involving child sexual abuse images as well. And on top of that, we had a lot of phishing attacks that seemed like they were still happening, targeting things like PayPal or Apple, and even a couple instances of Royal Bank of Canada.
Interesting. So when this traffic comes in, what were you all doing with it? Were you merely logging it, or were you trying to set a hook to see where things could lead next? What was the spectrum of responses that you all set up here?
So the honeypot was passively capturing PCAP data. For things like web traffic, our intent was to get the traffic that was coming in, but no responses would be sent back out. So, for example, if a request came in from a compromised bot to the honeypot, we'd see the request and then drop the traffic. And that was just to make sure that we're doing our due diligence and not interacting with what traffic was coming in. But it allowed us to see everything coming inbound, which painted a really interesting picture.
And part of it, we wanted to be careful with what we're sending back to these requests because, of course, many of these requests came from victims. And we didn't want to cause them any more harm than them already being infected with this bot. As far as the phishing sites go, we knew what kind of companies they were looking for based on the host names being used. But of course, then putting up a phishing site of our own and asking for the credentials would have been probably more than we should have done. So we just sent an empty page back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting insight, because I suppose you would have, if you were responding to anything, you'd have the risk of inadvertently triggering something, of setting something into motion without really knowing what you're doing, right?
Yeah. And one trick we did have, though, without actually sending a response, is when we're looking at the log files, we could see these hosts making requests for a specific IP over and over and over again for what looked like a phishing landing page. So when you scan those IPs through a sandboxing service, you can actually see other sites that are being hosted on that same IP. And when I did that, I ended up finding, you know, phishing landing pages for like Chase Bank and Apple ID. And it was some strange looking URL, but it had a perfectly designed credential harvesting page for Chase Bank. So even though once we got that request coming in, we knew the IP that the victim was looking for, then we scanned that particular IP and looked at a page that was offered back in time. It was not active, but in, you know, it's a cached page that was available at some point back in time.
Now, you also saw some, you were able to put together some information that you thought some of these botnets were doing crypto mining?
Well, we didn't specifically look at crypto mining. It was one of the accusations or one of the things that Cyberbunker is on trial for. What I ended up seeing specifically was IRC botnets, where it was using internet relay chat to communicate with a command and control server. And the reason that assumption was made is partly the volume of data from these random victim hosts all over the internet, communicating with just a handful of IP addresses in the Cyberbunker space. But what was interesting about it is the payload that was being sent had these computer names. So it would be like Linda PC and Lenovo 123 and HP Admin Office. So that kind of host name would indicate that there is some intent to compromise like a home victim computer, which is then calling home.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been fascinating to see, like, you know, one piece of this larger machine that's been disabled and so many other machines around the world calling back to it, trying to continue the communications. It must have been interesting to be able to gain insights from that.
It really was. And one thing I also should mention is that the traffic volumes we were getting was quite large. So my analysis was a 7-day period and an approximately 4-hour chunk of traffic on each day. And just that portion of time was about 40 or 50 gigabytes just worth of packet capture data. So there had to be some kind of limitation on the amount of data that we were analyzing. And just from that, IRC alone, we had about 7,000 unique source IPs and over 2,000 unique computer names, presuming they are computer names, which we feel that they are. So just in that small analysis window, you have, you know, 7,000 unique IPs still talking home to their C2 channel, which is enlightening.
Yeah, it's enlightening, but it's also frustrating. And yeah. Doing this for a while, this is really sort of one of the frustrations in this business that there are all of these infected systems out there, and it's really hard to clean them up. Now, given the short time we had, we didn't do sort of any effort of reaching out to these victims. But having done it in the past, usually the success rate is very bad on any kind of outreach like this. So once a PC is infected, it often stays infected for months or years.
Hmm. How do you go about deciding what you're going to spend your time on? When you're vacuuming up that much data, where do you begin? How do you set your priorities?
And that's always an interesting one. I think that's one of the skills you have to develop in this industry is you're given so much data and you got to figure out, well, where do I spend my time? And really, for me, it was just getting a baseline of the traffic and looking for odd deviations or things that stood out. You know, for example, I found the IRC botnet by simply looking at a smaller chunk of data and seeing the largest connection streams based on statistics in that sample data. And that kind of led me down the path. But you do have to make that determination of what do you actually look at? And there's a very strong possibility that things have been missed simply because it was a time-boxed exercise.
And the other problem, of course, is just like any IP on the internet, we also saw a lot of just random attacks, like Kareem in his paper talked about, like Mirai scans and things like that. Of course, it takes a little bit of experience there to be able to figure out this is just something that anybody connected to the internet will see versus this IRC traffic that's different and special and really related to some of the alleged activity the cyberbunker was involved in.
Was there anything particularly surprising and anything unexpected in terms of the traffic you were analyzing, things that that caught your eye, made you raise an eyebrow?
I think for me personally, it was the volume. Because we have to keep in mind that we're looking at this network a year, almost a year after it had been taken down. And the amount of traffic we're seeing is still so great. Now, I knew I expected to see some, but I didn't quite expect this much, especially since it's been reclaimed by another internet provider, let's say. Those hosts or whatever, you know, phishing landing pages, they're going nowhere. But yet it's still being actively prodded. So in a phishing campaign, you would expect that, you know, malicious emails being sent out and somebody's clicking on it. So for this, considering it's been so many months and you're still seeing those phishing pages being hit, it's quite enlightening.
What happens to this range of IP addresses now? Do they just get turned over to someone else, or do they stay dark for a certain amount of time? Where do they go?
Yeah, so the company that owns the IP address space now, they're actively involved in trading IP addresses. That's their business. Of course, with IPv4 address space being so scarce, they often end up with IP address space that sort of had a history like we have here. And I guess, you know, like anything these days, you have to disinfect it first.
So, yeah. I was thinking, like, you know, it's kind of like if you get a new phone and it turns out that your, you know, the phone number they give you used to belong to someone who either had a lot of friends or lived an interesting life or something like that, and you're getting all these phone calls and texts or whatever. Is to what degree do people have to worry that an IP address that they've been assigned has some sort of dark history behind it?
That's very common. And yes, you have to worry about this. So not only will you receive all this traffic that, you know, you're not interested in, that you're paying for this bandwidth that you're receiving here, but also because this IP address range has a history, it's now on all kinds of block lists and such. And in part, the company that uses or owns the IP address space now, one of their specialties is also to essentially clean that IP address space and prep it for resale.
I see. Yeah, interesting. Interesting. So what are the take-homes for you? When all was said and done and you were able to gather up the information, what were the main lessons that you all learned here?
You know, for what Johannes just mentioned, that was one of the big ones for me as well, is when you're getting access to an IP address space, it's important to at least take a cursory look at, you know, who had this before me? Is it on any known blacklist? Should I be checking it? I mean, for the average individual, it's going to be abstracted to the internet provider that's purchasing these blocks of IPs. But it's still an important factor to consider, because in this situation, you know, for example, we didn't see this, but if there's still credit card data being exfiltrated, it might be encrypted. But even if there was things like that being exfiltrated out of the environment, and you're now purchasing an IP that ends up being housed at someone's bank, and then it's getting credit card information from across the world, that could be a big implication for that organization. So important to at least take a quick peek to make sure that those IPs are safe and sanitized before you start using them.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, what if I'm suddenly receiving a stream of unsolicited child pornography or something?
Exactly.
Just because, you know, what, and could I... could there be some liability? Is it a danger for me? How do I turn off that fire hose if I inadvertently find myself in a bad neighborhood of the internet?
And that's why it's important to look at that before it comes in. And I mean, there would be a trace back activity to see where it came from. We know that this IP address space belonged to Cyberbunker in the past, but that's why it's important. Even just do a quick sanity check, you know, look at a block list that's already available on the internet, maybe run a basic packet capture to see the data that's coming in. Because that's what we did on the honeypot. We just had a packet captures running. We were able to do some analysis. And of course, the skill level is needed to do that. But presumably someone buying a block of of internet-facing IPs would do a quick sanity check.
Yeah. What sort of insights did this give you all to other bulletproof hosting sites? Were there any information you gained or insights from that?
It's definitely with Cyberbunker, it was, you know, their motto was, we will provide you with hosting without asking any questions. And it's important to realize that these types of organizations do exist. And when someone is wanting to engage in a cyber crime of some kind, they're going to need an infrastructure. And they're going to seek out organizations like this to help them with that, whether it's a distributed denial of service attack, illegal hosting. They're going to try and use a service like this. So I don't think this will be the last one we'll see for the foreseeable future, but it's definitely a good training exercise.
And I think the breadth of activity is also a little bit surprising, but or not surprising, depending on how long you looked at these kind of companies. They essentially engage in whatever criminals need to do business. So you have the entire range of cybercrime hitting an address space like this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I mean, are there any, I'm trying to think if there's any lessons to be learned for folks in the general defensive community. I mean, is there any tips or advice based on the traffic that you saw here for folks who are out there defending their own networks? Any insights there?
You know, when we're taught to do incident response and, you know, a lot of organizations, even at a much smaller scale, get hit with some kind of cyber attack. We always talk about making sure that we do a good and thorough job of cleaning up the host and not just, you know, pulling out the power cord and hoping for the best. But this is really a great example of that, because if your hosts are infected and you don't go through your eradication and containment phases properly, you risk these hosts continuing to engage in malicious activity long after things are unplugged. And I mean, this is a much larger scale. You know, most organizations say, well, we yank the cord out and hope that everything goes away. Well, here, not only have you yanked the cord out, you've taken the servers apart, you've sold it to somebody else, the IP address space is gone, yet you're still seeing traffic. So I think that's an important takeaway, where you can scale it down to a smaller organization trying to clean up their environment.
Yeah, and how many of these devices out there around the world that were sort of phoning home into this IP address space were still performing their primary functions the way they should be? The secondary activity going undetected.
And I think one lesson for the defender here is also with these hosts being still active 9 months later, as a defender, you have to check these block lists. You have to make sure that you're doing very simple indicators of compromise that you're pulling in. Yes, now there is often a lot of garbage in the sense that you get false positives, that you get the indicators that are really not of interest of you. But if your network is communicating with Cyberbunker IP address space, you should know that. And I think that's really something that administrators have to be aware of. What are these bad IP address spaces and what data am I sending to them?
Our thanks to Karim Lalji and Johannes Ulrich for joining us. The research is titled Cyberbunker 2.0, Analysis of the Remnants of a Bulletproof Hosting Provider. We'll have a link in the show notes. Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com. The CyberWire Research Saturday is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond,
Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.